The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening. Last Monday of 2019, and it feels a little bit kind of significant for me, maybe for you as well. And one of the things that I'm kind of delighting in is this number 2020 that's coming our way in a few days. I haven't heard anybody else talk about this, but I'm sure that lots of people must be thinking this, that 2020 means kind of perfect vision. I think of, with that kind of name, 2020, that it's the perfect year for vipassana, for mindfulness. Because the task of mindfulness is to see clearly and to have 2020 vision. And I delight in this, the way these four numbers appear together. I like the two zeros. Sometimes I think of them as eyes that see, and sometimes I think of them as spectacles, two lenses of a glass. And the zero is, you know, empty in the middle, and so it's clear, so we can see clearly. And that one of the tasks that we have is to always, as mindfulness practitioners, is to see clearly. And what does it mean to see clearly? I think what it means is to not obscure our mind's eye. So the ability for our mind to see what's happening, to be able to see without things being obscured or being misperceived. The other day there was a piece of cloth, orange cloth, that was kind of rolled up like a little roll, like a tube or something, just sitting kind of, somehow it was on the side, you know, about, you know, I don't know, 100 degrees to the side of me. So it was just kind of, my eyes just kind of glanced past it. And for a moment, I saw a carrot. And I really saw a carrot in my mind's eye. And then, shouldn't be a carrot there on the side of, you know, in the living room, that little table. So I looked down and then I saw clearly. I saw that it was just this little orange cloth that was rolled up. And my eyes had just very quickly picked up that pieces of that orange, pieces of that shape, not the whole thing, and had constructed in my mind the carrot. I do this regularly enough, I've done it 4 or 5 times this year when I go walking up here in the hills on the trails, and there's these tree branches that are kind of come up out of the trail a little bit, and they're kind of, you know, snake-shaped and about the size of a snake body or something. And probably 4 or 5 times this last year I saw a snake. And then when I saw clearly, I stopped to look. Then there was no more snake. There was just this little roots of the tree that were winding its way in the trail. So to see clearly means that we really take a good look. We really take a second look, a third look, really stop to look and see what's going on. And, you know, it's kind of cute maybe that when it's, see a orange cloth to be a carrot, or maybe it's not quite as cute to see roots being snakes. But we do this kind of thing in our mind all the time, where we take in just a little bit of data, and we've come to a quick conclusion. The terrible things when we do that for people, and we don't really stop to take the person in, but we have, you know, sometimes we have preconceived ideas, preconceived bias, preconceived judgments of people that are those kinds of people, whatever it might be. And I heard a presentation in the fall of an implicit bias, And they use the example, it's so common, but the person who did the talk used the example of old people and younger people. And they did some way of offering some kind of test to people. And it turned out that there was implicit bias against older people. The younger people preferred in some ways. And whatever the testing was. But that implicit bias was equally true for older people as it was for younger people. They had it as well, just kind of built in there. And it kind of was, you know, a little surprised that, but it seems like everyone, you know, that's a generalization, kind of does it. And so we do it to people from all kinds of ways. We do it. So to just stop and really take the time to see someone. And I think it's a wonderful thing to stop long enough to really try to see someone, to really take the time to take them in, take the time to have clear seeing, take the time to kind of be able to take your time and see them without the preconceived ideas or the judgments or the quick kind of impressions you have. But what do we, you know, what can we look and see in another person when we see them clearly, when we have 20/20 vision? And I think we see their beauty. Just like we see with our mind's eye, and the kind of seeing I'm talking about, the inside our ability to perceive, we're also kind of tuning in and seeing that person's inner life a little bit. We're tuning in and notice, knowing this is a human being who has had, who was born, grew up with, has certainly hopefully had joys, but probably had lots of trials and challenges. Maybe this is a person who sat in a infant chair and dining room table with their parents, caring for them and feeding them and just delighting that they were there and just loving them for who they were. That this was a person who probably had challenges going through puberty and teenagehood and into adulthood, and sometimes life is really hard for people. And I once took a workshop from Stephen Levine on death and dying. And in the courtyard before it started, all these people were milling around waiting to go in. And they were all, if you allow me to just say this just for the purpose of the talk, they were all completely normal people, whatever that is. And just like, you know, everyday normal people, just, you know. And and then we went into the workshop, and person after person stood up. Stephen Levine was a brilliant interactor. He was a pioneer in the whole death and dying movement in the United States, and he would do these phenomenal workshops. And people would stand up, one after the other, and talk about their grief that they had or their condition they had. They just lost a child, or they'd just been diagnosed with cancer. They were dying, and you know, so all this stuff was coming out. And I kept looking; my eyes got wider and wider. But these are normal people. You know, the normal people don't have those things. And so I was really young, so maybe you'll excuse me for having such naive thing. But it was kind of eye-opening for me. And after that, I don't take people for granted anymore. I don't think of people as being normal in the way I thought before. Now I think there's depth in people, the real depth of life experience, of situations, of challenges and things that they have in their lives. So what is it like to stop and see clearly, that sees the person in kind of some fuller humanity of who they are, so that enough so that we can respect them, enough so that we can care for them or appreciate them and value them. We have a world where a tremendous number of people are underappreciated, undervalued, underrespected. And to see clearly, to see others clearly, is to respect them, to see them, stop long enough to see them. So that's one of the things that clear seeing means. Another thing that clear seeing, we put on the vipassana, the mindfulness glasses, to see clearly. And you clean the lens so it's really clear and you see well through. There's no obscurations. How about seeing yourself? can you turn around and see yourself clearly? And that's one of the things we do in mindfulness. We stop to really take a look and see, you know, here. What's here happening here? Today I was talking with someone, and he said something like, you know, kind of a little bit diminishing his value and in relationship to other people, and said that he was like just a little pipsqueak or something. It was some language like that. And it was kind of painful to hear it. And in my role in the conversation, I was in the position where it felt appropriate to say that's not a, there's no need for that. Your job is to not be a pipsqueak. Your job is to stand up, stand tall, and hold your ground. And these people that he was kind of diminishing himself in relationship to, is really look them right in the eye and stand equal and be present in a strong way. And so this idea of seeing oneself as less than other people, seeing diminishing oneself and feeling embarrassed or apologetic or feeling like we're not adequate, is that really seeing yourself clearly? Or is that obscurations? Is that kind of this, your personal equivalent of seeing the carrot when it's a cloth next to you? Do we kind of have these quick judgments? Because the way the person said it, it came out of the mouth so quickly. It was like, you know, it was like almost like a passing statement that wasn't really supposed to be that important. But I thought that was the most important part of the conversation, that he would see himself that way. So to stop and to have clear seeing of oneself, so these judgments, these negative criticism, critical ways of seeing ourselves maybe are not there. And can we see the full humanity of ourselves? And that's a very important task of Buddhist meditation, is to, in some language, in Western language, in English, sometimes we say, being whole, becoming whole. In the ancient language, the language was unification. In the modern language, sometimes we call it, say it, integration. But ekagata, the way it's used in the, or ekodi, are these two wonderful words that relate to meditation practice, have to do with coming into some kind of wholeness, into a oneness, all the different parts of ourselves. So meditation is meant to do that, not to divide ourselves, to bring everything whole. And there's so many ways we're divided against these ourselves, or we're fragmented by our thoughts, our concerns, preoccupations, by our emotions, our feelings, our trauma we carry in our body. And the wonderful, really inspiring image for meditation practice comes from concentration, the similes for concentration. And that is that if you imagine a beautiful lake, and the water is refreshing and cool and wonderful, maybe, and there's no streams that come into the lake and no rain that comes into the lake. The only way the lake is refreshed is an underground spring at the middle of the lake the water flows out from this underground spring up into the lake. And it flows like a fountain. You know, if you could see it, you'd see like just like a fountain. You know, just kind of go up and spread out and fills the lake with this wonderful water. And this idea of filling the lake fully, so no part of the lake is not refreshed by this water, so the lake becomes complete. There's no kind of dead spots in the lake, or there's no walls in the lake. It all kind of flows everywhere. Is the image for meditation to sit and allow the whole kind of flow of vitality, of life, of presence, kind of flow throughout our whole body. That cannot happen if we're too much in our head, trying to be up in the control tower meditating, or if we're in the control tower judging, or if we're in the control tower, you know, fighting the control tower, or if, you know, if we're in a conflict with what goes on. To become whole, you can't be in conflict. To be whole, you can't be distracted. You can't be drifting off into the future or the past or something. And say that meditation is this, to really see oneself clearly, is this process of becoming whole, being unified or complete. And then can you respect yourself? Do you see yourself? So how do you see yourself so you can become whole? How do you see your full humanity? That's kind of the task of meditation practice. And so how do we stop and take a good look at ourselves? So this idea of having glasses, clear seeing, the two examples I gave, is to look out into the world and to look in towards oneself. And to be able to see clearly without reactivity, with equanimity, without our judgments and ideas, and also without the obscurations, the cloudiness that happens by our emotional reactivity. And if we're going to go into 2020, that I'm kind of hopeful for 2020. I feel very good about it, maybe because of this wonderful name. Hope is more than that. But I kind of expect good things in 2020. And but for that to happen, we really have to have people who see clearly. And we have to see what's happening with the environment, the global environment, the climate change. We have to see what's going on with the hate in our country and maybe around the world. We have to see clearly what's going on with the violence and the racism and the economic inequality and the the rhetoric that's used in politics, which is so awful these days. And you know, just so many, you know, things that we can see that are going on that can give rise to emotional reactivity. Anger, despair, grief, fear, all kinds of things. And when we have those emotions, are nothing wrong inherently in having those, except they do obscure the vision. Or they can obscure the vision. To sit and be whole, even with those feelings, so those feelings don't have the upper hand. Those feelings don't get in the way of our ability to see clearly. And this is the metaphor of also of sitting in meditation and sitting still and upright. Really being still. In meditation, we're learning the lesson of how to be present without picking up anything, getting involved with anything, pushing anything away. We're sitting still in the middle of being whole. We become the lake in which the underwater spring can kind of flow through it. And so we can see clearly. And if there's going to be some hope for this world of ours in 2020, we need a lot of people who are seeing clearly, have learned to do that. To see what's going on and become wise with that. So this idea of looking outward and looking inward. And when do we look outward? When do we look inward? Meditation time is a great time for looking inward. The rest of the time, maybe it's 50-50. I kind of like the 50-50 idea that we're constantly... There's one idea that we have two eyes, one to look in and one to look out. And so to this idea of a balanced looking at the inner universe and being familiar with it and being wise and knowledgeable about it, and looking at the outer universe and becoming knowledgeable at that, learning about it. For me, the idea of stopping to look clearly when we look into the world is to take time to learn what's out there. If something has really aroused your interest or your reactivity or you're upset about something, your curiosity about something, take time to learn about it. You can learn a lot without nowadays with the web without spending a lot of time. I had a long conversation with someone over this last few days about a particular politician, and so I got curious and was a little bit alarmed by this person, and so I went to see the person's Wikipedia page, and it wasn't a famous politician, but I was surprised how long the entry was, and it was a quick way of learning a whole bunch, and that was one way of using this ability to stop and see. When we talk about what's going on in the world, it's not enough just to be silent mindfulness people. That's not clear seeing. It's also to clear see, we have to take the time to sometimes learn and look under the surface and look beyond what's on the surface. Just like when we stop and get to know a person, it takes time to get to know them and really stop and look at them, get to take them in their full humanity, to get the full. Globality, the full globality of this globe, the wholeness of this world. It takes a little bit of research. You know, and if you just read the headlines of the news, if you just read the first paragraphs of the news, or just read the top articles in the news, you don't learn that much. It's not a really deep way to see. So there's a wonderful little story in the ancient world from the Buddha. There's this king named Pasenadi and his wife Malika. And Pasenadi asks his wife, the end of the story has a little bit more pizzazz if you think of him as being rather arrogant. And so in that arrogance, he asks his wife, who do you hold as being most dear? And probably in his arrogance, he's expecting her, like everyone else in the kingdom, supposed to say, well, you dear. You know, the king is the most dear person. So he asked, well, queen, who do you hold most dear? And she said, I hold myself most dear. And because she was kind of smart, she then, maybe she saw the eyebrows go up, she said to him, and who do you hold as most dear? And he said, well, I hold myself most dear, which maybe is not a surprise for someone who's arrogant. So then, this conversation apparently was significant enough that the king went to see the Buddha. They were they'd known each other, they're the same age, they'd known each other for a long time. And so the king often consulted with the Buddha, apparently. And so he came to talk to the Buddha and explain this little story, what had happened. And probably because he didn't agree with it. And the Buddha said, the Queen Malika is right. Each person holds themselves dear, most dear. And I love that little story. We hold ourselves dear. But is that enough? What about if we hold other people dear as well? We stop and use our clear seeing to see other people. So there's a different story that it's kind of nice for you to know if you haven't heard this. And if you have, you can think about different ways in which you can apply the story and different ways in which this little teaching is meaningful. So the story is in ancient India, there were these two acrobats. There was the acrobat and the acrobat's apprentice, it says. And they were they'd go in public and do these acrobatic tricks for donations. And so the master acrobat says to the apprentice, let's go and do our show. And while we do it, you watch over me and I'll watch over you. So you protect me and I'll protect you. And the apprentice says, no. you watch over yourself, and I'll watch over myself, and in that way we'll be safe. And so again, that someone went to the Buddha and said, had this conversation, this little disagreement about how they should do the acrobats. And the Buddha said, no, the apprentice is right, that you should watch over yourself, and that way you protect the others. That's what he said in the prose, and then he made a verse where he said this: protecting oneself, one protects others. Protecting others, one protects oneself. So you start by protecting yourself, and if you do that, you will protect others. So that's the kind of koan. That's the task of the poem to understand. How does that work? And if you're protecting others, then you will protect yourself. So it goes together. It's a wonderful mutuality that goes on. So protecting oneself, one protects others. Protecting others, one protects oneself. And how does one, in protecting oneself, protect others? By the repeated and frequent practice of mindfulness. And how does one, in protecting others, protect oneself? By patience and forbearance, by a non-violent and harmless life, by loving kindness and compassion. So we protect ourselves by being mindful. But in doing that, we protect others. How does that work? If you protect yourself, you're really protecting yourself against yourself. That's the whole thing. If you get, really, really upset by something that's happened, you're harming yourself in some way. If you get filled with greed, really full of lust or something for something, you're harming yourself. If you have hatred, you're harming yourself. And so there's ways in which you stop and take a look and really see what's going on internally. You'll notice, you'll become very sensitive to the ways in which your mind's activities is harming yourself. You'll feel the pain of it. Some people don't feel the pain of it. They're so externally focused. For example, people who hate and angry, that they don't really stop and take a real deep look and see what's really happening deep inside, what's going on for themselves. I've known people who have, people have come and told me about having anger or resentment towards others for years and years and years. And then at some point realizing that the other person probably has forgotten who they are. And the only person who's being harmed is themselves by carrying on the resentment. And these particular people, it was in that realization that allowed them to put down the resentment, when they realized how much they were harming themselves in that way. And so if you're mindful, you start seeing what you're doing in your mind, seeing how you're, what you're doing that's harmful. I did a wonderful thing. I don't know if wonderful was wonderful. It was a wonderful conversation. But it was kind of, it was a little bit unique. I've never been, believe it or not, in an Uber or a Lyft until this weekend. I was with someone. And so we got in. And so I like to sit in the front, these things, and taxis and stuff, and talk to the people and they're driving. And so, for example, I said, oh, I told them, this is my first time I've ever been in Uber. And then the first people I was with in the back seat said, Gil, it's a Lyft. So the driver asked, what do you do, to me? And I said, I'm a meditation teacher. And he said, I use meditation because I had an addiction to marijuana. And I used meditation to overcome it. And it was really made a big difference. I started to meditate, and I started to see how I was thinking. And I saw that my thinking was all wrong. And so I changed my thinking. Isn't that cool? So this is how we protect ourselves through mindfulness. We see what's going on in there. And we start relating to it differently. We start doing it differently. But how does that protect others? The things that, when we harm ourselves, those are forces inside of us. They're the same forces that harm other people. The forces that harm other people that we have inside of us is simultaneously harming ourselves. So if we have mindfulness and really pay attention and see what's going on here, you're not going to want to do that much longer. You'll want to change. And the very forces of harming other people is not something you want to keep doing. You will protect other people, and who are you protecting them from in the story? You're protecting them from you. And that's quite significant. So then it goes on, and how does one, in protecting others, protect oneself? By patience and forbearance, by a non-violent and harmless life, by loving kindness and compassion. By patience and forbearance. So this is when you don't give in to resentment and anger. I think that's the main purpose of patience and forbearance, is to not give in to anger, frustration, irritation, in ways that spill over, that causes more harm to yourself or to other people. And then to be nonviolent and harmless. People feel that you're harmless. When I was about 20, someone challenged me to a fist fight. And then, you know, the person was pretty serious. And I wouldn't recommend this as the obvious solution, but I wasn't planning to be in a fight, but there I was. And so what I did, it wasn't premeditated, what I did was I dropped onto one knee and opened my arms really wide, looked up at the person and said, "I can't fight." So, you know, I put myself in a pretty vulnerable space, right? I mean, the person got furious, spun around and walked away. So, you know, I protected myself by not willing to fight, to be harmless. So there's probably a lot better stories than that to be told. But that was my story. By nonviolent and harmless life, by loving kindness and compassion, be friendly, be kind, be compassionate. People tend to respond to you much better. There's no guarantee, of course, but people tend to. So if you're protecting others in this way, then they'll tend to protect you. They'll tend to treat you well. So this mutuality, this coming around and around. So this ability to see clearly, and really think of the seeing clearly, 20/20 vision, being both internally and externally. And this is also true at this global level, with our environment that we live in. If we don't see what we're doing to the environment, then we'll keep destroying the very thing that supports our life. If we cherish our life, then we'll want to cherish that which supports our life. To see ourselves clearly, to see the world clearly, I think is to start living a different life. To see that consumerism, for example, as an ism, is not going to work. We can't have a planet of getting close to 8 billion people and everyone having the lifestyle that those of us in this country, on the average, have. It's not going to work. And we can't have an economy that's built on more and more consumerism. It's just not going to work. It might work for another year or 2 years or 10 years, I don't know how long. But the amount of destruction that's going on, environmental destruction, is just phenomenal. The scale of it is phenomenal. So we're destroying. I grew up with in the Adriatic coast. And I used to spend vacations in coastline of Yugoslavia back when it was a communist country. Beautiful, beautiful islands. Beautiful coastline. Partly so beautiful because it was all stark rock with no trees. 2,000 years ago, all those islands were forested. And they were deforested. And then the soil washed away, and now nothing grows there. And this movement of humans destroying an ecosystem has been going on for probably 2,000 or 3,000 years, people say, where people overfarm, people destroy the trees, people do various things, overuse the water, and then destroy the very environment in which the humans were living in. This has been going on for a long time. It's not a new thing or a theoretical thing. It's just the scale of it is so big. The first time I heard this was I snuck away from high school in, I don't know when it was, 1969 maybe, 1970. And Richard Leakey was giving a talk at the university near my high school. Richard Leakey was a very famous archaeologist, anthropologist, who was, I think he was the one who discovered Lucy, I think. So the earliest human. So he's very famous back then, an archaeologist, anthropologist. So he was giving a talk at the university. And he said in 1969, so 50 years ago, he said in the natural world, animal world, that animals that over-specialize become extinct. And I think the example he used was like big mammoth, big elephants, you know, that had these really... He talked about, I forget exactly what animal it was, but it had really, really, really big tusks. And these tusks were so, so big, they became so cumbersome, they couldn't really protect themselves anymore, they couldn't really function very well, and so they went extinct. That was the some example like that, but 50 years ago, and, you know, as a teenager, I didn't know what quite to make of it. It sounded like an interesting theory. But over-specializing, overusing. So how do we, with our 2020 vision, how do we see that? And the Buddhist way of seeing is that there's a mutuality. Protecting others, we protect ourselves. Protecting ourselves, we protect others. Protecting the world, we protect ourselves. Protecting ourselves, we protect the world. The idea is to go round and around. And one of the ways, if you protect yourself, turn your mindfulness inward, is you see the pain, the suffering that comes with overemphasis on consumerism, on wealth, on things and acquisitions, and, you know, there's all these ways in which we want more and more and more, all these ways we're not paying attention to the impact we have. And if we see the suffering, the dissatisfaction of that lifestyle, then we'll want to live a different way. And then the Buddhist ideal of renunciation is not a diminishment of ourselves, but rather an enhancement. Remember, the meditation is to make ourselves whole, make ourselves unified, to make ourselves from the inside out wealthy, to make us feel really like we're deeply contented and happy and delighted and filled with well-being. We're not searching for well-being externally, by things and people and experiences, but to really have it inside. Imagine to be wealthy spiritually and not to need then satisfaction from things and experiences and things out there in the world to be a certain way. Then it's a lot easier to renounce things of the world and to live a lifestyle that doesn't harm the world so much. That doesn't rely on the exploitation of other workers around the world. And to take really into the world, see clearly what's going on out there. Take the time to learn what's happening in the world. And care for that which supports us. Then we'll care for that, and that in turn supports us. If we let consumerism, the ism of consumerism and economic growth, and all the greed that involves to keep kind of barreling along, destroying more and more of the planet, guess who else is going to be destroyed in the process? Our over-specialization of our life will end up in the same place as the woolly mammoths and the dinosaurs and the dodo birds, all these things that are now extinct. So 2020 vision is a great thing. And maybe as we go into this next year, we'll be reminded probably every day, 2020. And maybe instead of writing the date, you know, 1/1/20, maybe we should all write 1/1/2020 just to be reminded over and over again. Let's look clearly. Let's see clearly. And let's have a vision. Let's have a vision of a better world that we can live in. So, best wishes for the New Year's, and I hope you keep your glasses clean.